Up tonight, Northwestern takes on Ohio State at Welsh Ryan Arena in Evanston. The Wildcats have dropped three games in a row by a total of just 9 points. Ohio State, meanwhile, is coming off a 55-50 loss at Wisconsin that snapped a four-game winning streak. The Chicago Bulls face off tonight against the Milwaukee Bucks, one of the teams the Bulls are chasing for a playoff spot. Chicago is 10th in the Eastern Conference, 2.5 games behind the 8th place Bucks. The Bulls lost to Miami 95-93 on Thursday, but still have won 5 of 8 games before the All-Star break. The Bucks, meanwhile, have won 3 straight. The St. Louis Blues have beaten the Columbus Blue Jackets 5 straight times and 7 of the last 8 going into tonight's game in Ohio. St. Louis has scored 9 times in 2 of those wins this season. The International Amateur Boxing Association has voted to move ahead with a bid to include women's boxing in the Olympics, starting with the 2012 Games in London. Boxing is the only one of 26 Olympic summer sports federations without female competitors. And NCAA President Miles Brand says he's taking an aggressive course of chemotherapy to fight his advanced pancreatic cancer. The former Indiana University president learned of his diagnosis Christmas Eve. Doctors told him a few days later that his cancer was inoperable. That's a look at sports.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Truppen at 2125 South Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan for State of Illinois employees and is accepting new patients. More information is available at 356-3736.
California lawmakers met until the early hours of this morning but failed to adopt a plan to close California's budget gap. The budget gap exceeds $40 billion. Among state Senate Republicans, the debate became so contentious that they ousted their leader. He had helped craft a budget proposal that most of his fellow Republicans opposed. After days of marathon sessions, the budget remains one Republican vote shy of passing. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
That one Republican vote is needed in the Senate, and it's still nowhere in sight. The leadership tried old-fashioned horse trading, tried locking senators in the chamber overnight, and Senator Daryl Steinberg, leader of the majority Democrats, tried just plain begging his Republican colleagues.
And I wish to God that you could deviate just a little bit from your philosophy, just a little bit from the endless mantra of no new revenue, no new revenue ever.
And there's a lot of new revenue in this budget deal, roughly $14 billion of increases in personal income taxes, gas taxes, car taxes, and sales taxes. There are comparable cuts in services, but that's not what's worrying Republican lawmakers.
I just think that raising taxes on the average Californian is exactly the wrong-headed way to go,
says State Senator Sam Onestad, who represents the northeastern corner of the state. Like all of the GOP lawmakers in Sacramento, Onestad has signed a pledge to never raise taxes.
Unless it's an extreme emergency such as earthquakes and the Bay Bridge is collapsing, et cetera.
The Republicans have gotten a lot of encouragement and a lot of threats to help them stick to their anti-tax pledge. One conservative blogger said that any GOP lawmaker who votes for the budget should be censured at the upcoming California Republican convention. And talk radio has been all over the budget story.
These cowardly, slimy, deceitful b****s are going to rape you for $70 billion.
That's the John and Ken Show on KFI in Los Angeles. Their website has a photo feature that shows the heads of a dozen politicians impaled on sticks. All of them are their fellow Republicans.
We're going to recall all you b****ers. We don't care if you voted for the tax or not. Doesn't matter. Forget it. You're gone.
Meanwhile, as the state budget standoff has dragged on, the state controller stopped sending out income tax refunds and suspended payments to the counties for basic social service programs. And if there's not a deal soon, 10,000 state employees could be laid off and hundreds of transportation projects shut down at the cost of another 90,000 jobs. But Senator Sam Onestad complains that this budget deal doesn't trim enough workers from the state payroll.
you know, here we are in an economy where major corporations across America, and especially in California, are laying off workers by the thousands, and yet this entire budget proposal does not lay off one California state worker. At a time when private enterprise is trying to tighten their belt, we don't see government making the same gesture.
California is the only large state that requires a two-thirds vote to pass a budget. That's why three Republican votes are needed in each house of the Democrat-dominated legislature. Dan Schnur is the head of the Jess Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California. He says the Democrats will find that one last elusive Republican vote in the Senate, and probably soon.
The question is what else Democrats are able to give up at the risk of angering their constituencies in order to get more Republicans to cross party lines and anger theirs.
And once that budget is passed, there will still be plenty of anger to go around as Californians face painful cuts in services and higher taxes in hard times. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Ronald Allen Stanford is a wealthy Texas financier. He attracted investors with certificates of deposit well above what others were offering. Now the Securities and Exchange Commission says he presided over a multi-billion dollar fraud. Stanford is being compared to Bernard Madoff. The government has now taken over Stanford's operations. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Dallas.
Having suffered months of humiliating accusations that the Securities and Exchange Commission was asleep at the regulatory switch, yesterday federal agents roared up in tinted Chevy Suburbans and raided the offices of Robert Allen Stanford's companies. Stanford is a Texas entrepreneur who made his initial fortune in Houston real estate. He's now accused of duping tens of thousands of investors out of billions of dollars. Most of the alleged scheme involved what the SEC branded, quote, self-styled certificates of deposit sold by Stanford International Bank. Whenever a federal regulatory agency uses the word self-styled to describe a financial product you've invested in, it's not a good day. The SEC alleges that, like financier Bernard Madoff, Stanford consistently supplied investors with false information and unrealistic returns. Some investors said they were getting CD rates as high as 8.25%. Stanford's companies have allegedly resisted the federal government's attempts to account for the billions of dollars that were supposedly in safe, liquid investment vehicles. The Texas billionaire's whereabouts are unknown. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
It's 2:48. Recently, two reports on the future of automobiles came out. They looked at cars and trucks from very different perspectives, but came to similar conclusions. Lester Graham reports.
The first of these two reports was published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. It looked at what it would take to get U.S. automobiles to reduce the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide enough to lower it to 1990 levels. Why cars? Well, because cars and trucks produce a third of U.S. CO2 emissions. Greg Keolian is one of the authors. He's at the University of Michigan. He says there are three things that need work. We need to drive less, burn cleaner fuels, and within about 40 years, increase the average fuel mileage way beyond the 20 miles per gallon we're getting now.
And that would need to increase to 136 miles per gallon to meet the carbon targets. Alternatively, if we just focused on fuels, basically, we need about 80% cellulosic ethanol by 2050. And the third scenario, looking at a reduction in driving, it would mean we'd have to cut our driving in half by 2050.
Now, the study says it's unlikely we can accomplish any one of those, and the study's authors suggest it'll probably be a combination of more efficient cars, better fuels, and driving less if we're to reduce greenhouse gases enough to make a difference. The second report, entitled Envisioning an Uncertain Future, comes from the Boston Consulting Group. It looks at the future of the automobile from a business perspective. One of the authors, Xavier Mosquet, says the study assumes rising oil prices will force some changes.
You know, we believe that, you know, the oil prices will be very high and that the pressure from the consumer on the governments will be so high that the governments, you know, will have to take energetic actions to develop, you know, green products and green cars.
But the report notes green cars will cost more, as much as $15,000 more for hybrids or plug-in hybrids compared to standard cars.
The consumer will look at these cars and say, well, this is more expensive than I can pay, and therefore they're not going to buy them. So what I think the government has to do, if we want to go that way, is to look at the cost of putting those technologies on the market and either, you know, basically subsidizing the car manufacturers and suppliers or, you know, helping the consumer with much more tax incentives. Otherwise, it will not happen.
So from a business perspective, the Boston Consulting Group report suggests without government help, manufacturers won't be able to build the more efficient cars at a price we can afford, but we'll need them because of high oil prices. The University of Michigan report on cars and climate change agrees the government will have to take a major role. Author Greg Keolian says if we take climate change seriously and we're committed to doing something about it, we'll have to change driving habits, encourage innovative manufacturers, and invest government money.
We are capable of doing this, and the cost to society of climate change is tremendous, and each sector needs to play a major role in addressing the needs to reduce.
As we said, these two studies look at the future of the automobile from very different perspectives, but both agree we need more efficient cars, and that won't happen without the government pushing a little and helping a lot. For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
That's 252. The record for the most coaching wins in college basketball does not belong to men like John Wooten, Dean Smith, or Bobby Knight. It was recently set and set by a coach who earned victories far from the country's biggest arenas. As Gary Ellenbolt of South Dakota Public Broadcasting reports, Don Meyer did it, and he did it while seriously ill.
Sports fans love an underdog. It's deep in the American nature to root for those who rise from humble beginnings to become a winner. It's hard to find a coach more humble than Don Meyer, the coach at Northern State University in Aberdeen, South Dakota.
You know, when you start out 5-20, like I did, you learn to take it a game at a time right away. Only guy that lost more games than me my first year was Digger Phelps. So I knew I wasn't a very good coach because I was next to Digger Phelps, you know what I mean, on losses.
That losing season was 37 years ago at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Since then, Don Meyer has added more than 900 victories. Last month in Aberdeen, he became college men's basketball's all-time winningest coach with a 20-point win over the University of Mary. Watching Meyer work the sidelines, you notice that his facial expression rarely changes. It's a serious expression that can be interpreted as gruffness. But he makes it clear his goal is not setting records, but helping his teams improve.
And if you're a leader and you're not a servant leader, then you're not a leader. We got a lot of people in this country who want to be leaders, but they don't want to be servants.
Meyer is coaching this season from a wheelchair. He pushes himself across the floor with his right leg. He lost the left leg in a traffic accident in September and spent nearly 2 months in the hospital. While there, doctors discovered cancer, and they're telling him it's inoperable. But he's not thinking about his health issues while the game's going on.
No, it's a game at a time, and if you ever lose that perspective, just like it's a day at a time, when you come through the thing I've come through, it's a day at a time. Every morning I wake up, I check to make sure I'm alive, and then I start thanking God for being alive, and then I hope I can do something good with that day, because I don't know how many days I got left, to be honest with you, and none of us know.
Of the 903 wins Meyer has earned as a college coach, not one has come at the Division I level. From his difficult beginning at Hamline, he went to a very successful career at Lipscomb University in Nashville. Regardless of where the victories were, NPR sports commentator and author John Feinstein says Meyer's accomplishment is remarkable.
What people forget is you got to be really good to be around a long time, because if you're not, you don't get to stick around. And it's a tribute to longevity, it's a tribute to competitiveness, it's a tribute to the kids he's coached, and it's a tribute to the decisions he's made on who he's going to coach.
Northern State Wolves fan John Schwann has a special interest in this team. His son, Kyle, is a starting guard. Schwann sees special meaning in Meyer's record.
He's done it for every small-time coach that's had to put in the windshield time, work with small budgets, and build a team.
Really the only one not enjoying the record seems to be Don Meyer himself.
It can't be all about the coach. It's got to be all about the team.
Don Meyer says he'll let Northern State's fans celebrate his milestone. After all, a difficult schedule in the Northern Sun Intercollegiate Conference is still ahead. For NPR News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt in Vermilion, South Dakota.
An upcoming Supreme Court case will likely force the Obama administration to offer quick answers to questions about its approach to fighting terrorism. The case involves the only alleged enemy combatant being detained on mainland America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Mayer. She writes about the case in the current New Yorker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tune in tonight at 7.
Earth and Sky.
Ancient Mars, like the Earth today, hosted a variety of watery environments.
You're listening to Bethany Ellman. Ellman led a study that's opened up the possibility that life existed on the planet Mars deep in its past. She's on the science team of a NASA mission that looks at minerals on Mars's surface. What Ellman found were patches of magnesium carbonate.
So carbonate is kind of a signature mineral of neutral to alkaline pH conditions in the waters from which they formed.
Scientists have thought that long ago, 3.5 billion years ago, Mars was intensely acidic and inhospitable to much possibility for life. But Ellman's study suggests otherwise. We asked her why.
Because carbonate tends to dissolve in acid, and the fact that we see carbonate persisting to the present means that it never experienced these acid conditions, and instead it preserves a record of ancient Mars that was of neutral to alkaline pH and perhaps more clement to life.
The carbonate is similar to limestone on Earth, and like limestone fossils, fossils of early Martian life might be preserved in the carbonate found on Mars.
Well, I think that's a possibility that all of us dream about.
Ellman added that future landed missions to Mars might answer questions of whether life ever existed on the Crimson Planet. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support comes from the Technology Entrepreneur Center, hosting an invention-to-venture workshop for faculty and others on technology entrepreneurship with a focus on the life sciences on Saturday, February 21st at the Chemical Life Science Lab. More at inventiontoventure.org/urbana09 or 244-4035.
Mike Solis forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight. Cloudy, windy, and colder in northern and eastern Indiana. Snow showers and flurries in the far south. Light rain changing to flurries. Elsewhere, occasional flurries. Lows tonight ranging from around 10 in northwestern Illinois to 25 in the south. Tomorrow, in northern and eastern Indiana, mostly cloudy with numerous snow showers. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 20 in northern Illinois to 38 in the far south. For Champaign-Urbana tonight, cloudy, windy, and colder with flurries, possibly a snow shower. The low tonight.